Now, Iona Rosley represented Great Britain in speed skiing and also rode on the Irish equestrian team. But a lot happened in between. She was constantly looking for the answer to finding peace, hope and purpose. Well, did she find it? She's here to tell us. Great to have you on the show with us, Iona.
Thank you so much, Selena. Thank you.
And thank you for staying up so late. I know you're in Australia.
But I think in Spain you actually wake up at 9 o'clock in the evening and go out for dinner. In
some
Australia,
people
we go
do.
To bed, we go to bed at 9. We're very boring.
So what was it that drew you to speed skiing? Why did you get into that?
Well, I was a ski instructor, and I was posted as chief ski instructor in a resort called Les Arcs. 2000, which is in France, near Albeville. And they have a kilometre lancé track, which in English is the flying kilometre. And as ski instructors, we used to watch these professional skiers go straight down at 200 kilometres an hour.
Wow.
And we used to sit there thinking, why on earth would you do that? Because it looks so dangerous. And we saw some fairly amazing falls, which made me think there's no way on this planet I would ever do this. And I ended up doing it, which is rather remarkable because we had maybe 12 people working for me when I was chief ski instructor, and they all wanted to have a go at speed skiing. And as ski instructors, you were allowed to go halfway up the track. So we hired helmets and skis, and I said, yeah, but I'll try it. I didn't want to wimp out because I was chief instructor. I didn't particularly want to do it, I have to admit, even though I'm very competitive and I was skiing in slalom and giant slalom and, you know, doing lots of other competitive sports. But this was like another level. So I got to the halfway point where everyone was supposed to meet to find out that none of my teammates were there. So they all decided to chicken out.
Oh, that's rotten, isn't it?
Yes, nice. And they're all at the bottom waiting. So the marshals sort of took one look at me and realized I was absolutely terrified. And he said, well, you can walk down. You know, and I was like, there's no way I can do that. There's pride. I can't do that. Or you can ski down. And, you know, he went to show me what he called an egg position. He said, if you do this, you'll get a really fast speed. And I was like, I'm just not interested in that. I just can see scrambled egg all over, you know, track. And I was thinking, this is not funny. But I did it. And it's a bit like jumping out of a block of flats.
I'm
not sure that many people have done that and don't do it, but it was amazing. And before you knew it, you were at the bottom, and the slope curves upwards, so you don't have to do anything. You automatically slow down. And I was just, the adrenaline was pumping through me. I was like, wow. And I got to the bottom, and all my friends were there laughing and shouting and screaming, and it took me a while before I could actually speak. And I just said, right, who's next? And they all looked at me and they weren't going to go up. And I just decided I want to do that again.
Wow.
And it just started from a prank. I mean, I am very competitive. But I looked at this thinking, well, what's the point of going in a straight line? But it became it's not for the faint-hearted, obviously. It took me to another level of realizing that I could overcome fear.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. So you went from there, from enjoying it, to turning professional. I mean, what sort of training do you have to do then? Do you just keep having to go up and down and going faster and faster?
No. Well, actually, no. The training is actually more off the slope than on, I would say. It was a lot of weight training, running, but it's more of a mental sport. I think it's probably 50-50, mental and physical. That if you have a negative thought on the way down at that speed, one of your muscles would tense up and you'd fall.
Oh, wow. Yeah, of course.
If your thumb slowly came up, you would actually probably do a backward flip. So everything, it's negative resistant. You have to be relaxed at 160 kilometers an hour, but be able to hold your skis pointing down the hill that actually weren't even touching the slope because you're hydrofoiling. So it's a totally, we did a lot of visualization, mindfulness or meditation, if you want to call it that, where your mind and your body, you know, they work so closely together. So you could visualize in your bedroom floor the race the day after. And by the time you got to the racetrack, you were just actually replaying it all over in your mind again. So there was, it's a huge mental sport. And I'd say that was the thing that allowed me to do it to the degree that I did, was mainly because I was quite mindful and being aware that your thoughts can really affect everything you do in life.
Do you think it sounds great, the mind and body being together, and I can totally understand where your mind would have to be totally concentrated. Do you think it became a bit of an obsession with you?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. But unfortunately, I pick up on things and I don't let go. It's a bit like a Rottweiler with a bone. And I want to be the best. And I just, that was it for me. I went off and I decided I need to get sponsors. Just so that I could travel the world and do just this. So I went off to Birmingham Motor Show. I walked in and I spoke to Alfa Romeo. They said, yes, we'll sponsor you. And I was like, oh, okay.
Blimey.
And then Smirnoff had a speed skiing team. And I went to see Smirnoff and they agreed to put me on the team, which was brilliant. So, and no, I didn't drink and drive because then I wasn't actually drinking. So I was sponsored by Smirnoff and Alfa Romeo cars. And yeah, so there aren't that many races in a year. So every single race you did, there was about 200, 250 skiers from all over the world. I think at that time there were maybe only 5 or 6 racing tracks in the world.
Wow, yeah.
It was intense.
Yes, I can imagine. And I'd have definitely needed a couple of vodkas before I went down. I'd have been saying, come on, Smirnoff. So did you manage to hit the speed that you were initially watching, the 200 kilometres per hour?
No, my fastest speed then was 160, which is quite a long time ago. So I won the British 1986 Overseas Championship and then 1986 New Zealand Championship. So 160 was my speed skiing career was very short. It was 2 years. And then I had this major accident.
Yes, sort of
blew everything out of the water. Really.
Tell us what happened, because I know you were going at 160 kilometres an hour then. So what happened? Did you move your thumb?
Well, yeah. So what happened was I did one run and it was good. And this is a pre-qualifier for the world champion. And this is 1987. Everything was going fine. I started off and it was very, very steep, but way up in the gully. And within seconds, my right ski just came off.
Oh, crikey.
So I was traveling on one ski in an egg position. And I was so, obviously, that's not supposed to happen. Mm-hmm. So they say you're just supposed to fall, but and just relax and fall. And I didn't. I was like, no, I'm not having this. So I put my heel down to try and stop myself, which is probably a very Irish thing to do. I actually put my heel down and it shattered my leg into about 9 places.
Oh, no.
Because I was already traveling over 100 and something kilometers an hour. And then I fell down the track for a kilometer and I went through the speed trap at about 160 kilometers. So I did, and I'm not sure if I still am the fastest lady on my bottom, which is not a title I really wanted to have.
Oh, bless
so,
you.
It was fairly, and it's very strange because within a second, it was all over. But when I was falling, it was like being in a tumble dryer in slow motion.
Yes, I'm sure.
And I knew in my mind the other people that had fallen there, the other skiers, had actually died. Mm. So as I was falling, I just felt, this is it, I'm finished.
Oh, how frightening.
And but my first thing was my dog. I was, who's going to look after my dog? Which is a very strange thing to think about. But and then I just felt there was this hand, like a divine presence, which I've never felt before. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. But I did think that was it until I got to the bottom. I managed to sit up. I looked at my leg and then I passed out. That was it for a while.
Well, the doctors actually thought that there's no way that you could survive. They say it's miraculous that you lived at that speed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
Incredible, incredible.
And the best place in the world to break your leg is in near Albertville. They have the most amazing orthopedic surgeons. How they actually put my leg back together, I don't know, because looking at the x-rays, it wasn't even a leg. It was just splintered bones everywhere. So above my knee, below my knee, amazing what they did. But they did say within 2 days they came in and, you know, it was an 8-hour operation. And they just said, look, we're really sorry. You know, you will never be able to do any sports ever again.
Oh, but that didn't stop you.
You will always limp. No, it didn't. I just looked at them and I was like, yep. Whatever.
Well,
so I wasn't taking that.
No, that's what I was just reading. You had a plate and 28 screws holding your right leg together. Oh my goodness.
So
then, obviously, I mean, for most of us, that would be it. That would be a warning. You were lucky to be alive, but it didn't stop you. You then moved to the Middle East. What happened there?
Yeah, so I went to Cyprus to recover it took me about a year and a half to learn to walk again. And in that time I was horse riding, because my favorite hobby outside of skiing was always been horses. So when I got to the Middle East, I actually ended up working with the Rothmans Williams Renault Formula One team. So I traveled around for 5 years with them, with Damon Hill, David Coulthard. But in between that, I was show jumping. I was playing polo. My horses were really important to me. And I was longing to get back into really serious competitive sport. And then an opportunity came along when I started competing in long-distance horse racing. So it's 120, 160 kilometers in a day on horseback. And, I became obviously very obsessed with that. We ended up with 19, 23 horses and traveled all over the world, got onto the Irish team. So we did the World Equestrian Games. Actually, the first World Equestrian Games I did was in Spain, in Jerez, in 2002.
Lovely.
We have a very, very strong connection with Spain. My husband loves the food and the wine.
Ah.
The red wine. So we love Spain. We love hiking there. We were at the World Equestrian Games in Jerez, which was amazing. So I had 8-9 years on the Irish team, competing at a fairly high level, obviously. And that was, I loved it. It was just so amazing. Just great to be, I love my horses, I love my animals. So I was training and competing and going all over the world with the horses.
It is incredible, because I know that riding puts such a strain on your legs, you know, at the best of times, you know, your foot's in the stirrup and that's it. But you managed it okay, clearly.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, my main thing for anybody is when the doctor tells you something, always go and get a second opinion. I don't think I went to get a second opinion. I just really worked hard on being physically fit. So even my leg now, when you x-ray it, it shouldn't actually be doing what it's doing. But I think that's more to do with weight training and building muscle around your knee. I'm not very good at walking on a horse, but if I'm trotting and cantering and galloping, that movement keeps my knee working perfectly, so it's fine. So endurance just fitted really well. And you do jump on and off, so there's a little bit of, you know, running uphill, running downhill, stuff that I shouldn't even be able to do, but I'm doing. I did do. I don't do it anymore. But I still jump on and off. I mean, I was riding this morning. We have horses in Australia, but that's just a hobby now. So, yeah, it's interesting times. It was just an amazing time to be involved in. You know, my mum is Irish, so I'm obviously part Irish, so to be able to compete at that level was amazing.
An honour, I should imagine. I've read so much about you before this interview, but one thing I couldn't find out, it said that you did have several successful and happy years on the Irish team, but then your life took an unexpected turn, and I can't find out what happened, so you'll have to tell us.
Oh dear, that's a very long story.
Oh, is it? We've got time.
I was actually brought up as a Catholic, and I went to a convent school. And even though they tried to get rid of me or expel me quite a few times, because I was rebelling against the system, and you know, I didn't want to be involved in anything remotely religious, anything to do with rituals or traditions, I couldn't quite handle. My favourite thing in convent school, in church, which we did every day, was to sit on the end of pew and pretend to faint. So I'd just roll over into the middle of the aisle, and the nuns would drag you out. And I did it every day. They went with it. They just never clocked on that I was faking it. So when I left school, I was walking. I ran away from anything that looked anything to do with Jesus or God. I just didn't quite. I wasn't then able to join all the dots. But all the way through, my mum was a very, very prayerful, very godly lady. And I know she was praying for me all this time. I think when I had a big skiing accident, I really felt like it was God trying to stop me from going down a road where I would have killed myself, which I probably would have.
Yeah.
And then I had a brief meeting, I would say, with the real Jesus in Cyprus at a retreat. But as soon as I realized that I was fit and healthy, I jumped on a plane and I flew back to England to become a jockey. And then obviously then I went on to the Middle East. And so many times I walked away from Jesus, from God, that it was unbelievable that he never left me alone. And I started to realize that even when I was winning and doing well and I had the money, I had the media coverage, I was working on television, I was doing the sports, you know, I'd wake up in the morning feeling quite empty, especially after a race where I'd done really well. That would take you like a year to 2 years to get to that point. And I'd wake up feeling I should feel different. And I don't feel different. And that would, every time that happened, I felt that the hole inside me just got bigger and deeper. And when I went to the Middle East with the horses, I started to go down every single route of trying to find what life was all about, whether I've tried Buddhism, crystals, Reiki, I went to tarot card readers. I dived in and out of the Bible. For me, it was a history book. I didn't quite manage to connect the dots again there. So it wasn't until we moved from Dubai to France and I met the most amazing couple who also had horses. And they lived nearby, and they sort of lived and breathed Jesus. And I was, like, blown away. But they used to pray into everything, and I go, whoa. But they were just so compassionate and loving. And for me, they just brought Jesus alive. And he said he's very much alive. And that's not what I was brought up to believe, that, you know, for me he was in a book, and if he was alive he lived on a planet in the galaxy somewhere, and he wasn't really interested in me. So they took me down this route, which was amazing. And I really felt, if you'd asked me if I was a Christian, I would have said yes.
Mm.
But God needed to step in and show me that I thought I was, but I wasn't. And I think it saw this about possessions and identity. My identity was in sports. My identity was in winning and competing. So I was I was getting ready for the World Equestrian Games in America, and I was in the top three of the Irish riders, and I'd never not qualified for anything. And my horse got really sick the day before the qualifier, and I haven't really failed as such in the horse riding world in endurance, and that really blew me away. And I think if anyone is not competitive, they wouldn't understand this, but I had spent 3 years trying to get this little horse ready for this race, mm-hmm. and this happened. So my immediate attack was to God, because I said, look, we had a relationship. I sit in the Bible. I pray. I do this. I do that. And he was just felt like he just walked away and left me. And my reaction to having this taken away from me was not healthy. I really totally lost it. I changed personality, I would say. And over a 2 day period, I was a bit of a monster. I got home. My French friends turned up. They were trying to console me, and they said, "Let's pray." I said, "Do you know what? I don't want to, because he just walked out and left me, and I just really feel that, you know, I've just felt abandoned. I felt like someone had died in the family, but he'd taken away what I wanted to do." And I think it was 2 days after the race, I was in our farmhouse in France, and I was on my own, and I hadn't slept that night. I was so upset. I remember walking downstairs into the kitchen, and I saw my Bible and my do list. I always do lists every morning. And it was almost like Jesus had walked into the kitchen. It was like he walked in, and I was overwhelmed by a sense of love. And I just felt him. I knew that he'd never left me. I'd left him.
Oh, what a great story.
So it was like he just said, look, you know, I've always been here for you. And I think in that moment, I realized that the only way of getting that emptiness filled is actually by letting go of what you want, your identity, because he gave us our personalities. He knew exactly what I should be and what I should do, and it wasn't that. I'm competitive, and he's given me that, which is amazing. But it was in that moment that I suddenly realized, and I said, do you know, I don't want to live the way I've been living. I just want to be the person you created me to be. And when you surrender everything over to Jesus, it's like you have this amazing sense of freedom and peace. And some people think Christians become clones, but he gave us our personalities, so he adds to you. And within an instant, I would say my life in 1 second turned upside down and inside out. Mm. But he had to take away everything from me to show me that there is so much more when you let go, and it's freedom to do what he wants you to do, which is, you know, it's your passion, it's what he wants you to do. So, yeah, it was amazing.
It was a moment, yeah.
I would never change that. Yeah.
Oh, wonderful. Well, you've put your story into a book called Racing on Empty, and you say it's written for all those who feel broken and lost and have nowhere to turn. It is out now, so we can buy it now, and it's just an incredible story. I feel like I've said wow so many times during this interview, but it's because you're such a force of nature. You really are, Iona. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Please stay safe and healthy. Don't go and do anything else. Just enjoy life with your horses now.
Yes, we will do. Don't worry. And down in Australia, down under.
Let us know as well when all this lockdown's over, when you come over to Spain, and we'll have you in the studio.
Yes, that would be great, and we all definitely will, because it's our favourite place for hiking and drinking very good red wine and amazing food and amazing people.
Fantastic. Thank you, Iona. You take care and you can go to bed now. Thanks for staying up so late.
All right. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye. Bye. Okay.